In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball. Let's all go
to the lobby. 21 after 5. It's time for Pass the Popcorn, brought to you by Bangor Mall Cinema 10, Stillwater Avenue, Bangor, where they have a film for everybody in the family. Alan Adams from The Main Edge is here. He braved the crap that's out there to make his way in. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, some garbage out there.
It's awful. Yeah. Oh, your chair is collapsing.
Yeah, something
on
just
you.
Happened. That's great. We're good. Yeah, we're all good.
You're down to my level now. Thanks. I like that. You had a very busy weekend, sir. The Improv Me Festival, 6th annual, according to everybody I talked to, a smashing success.
Yeah, it was really great. The attendance was lovely. Had a lot of folks there for all three sessions. The performances were great. Some really good times. We're had by all. Like we had a really good time, and now I don't have to think about it for another 6 months.
But a tip of the cap to Andy Gagan, our friends at Gagan Brothers Brewing, for taking care of business again this year.
Like, they've been our producing sponsor since the beginning, and so they've always been very supportive. But they went the extra mile this year because for those who don't, their hours have shifted a little bit, and they we were willing to do whatever was necessary to make things easier so we could spend some time there. And they didn't even blink. They were just like, oh, yeah, we'll just stay open a little bit longer for you folks. Nice. And it was just like, come on. Like, you just don't see that very often, And so it's just like, so kudos to them. And, we're just so grateful to have that relationship. And we look forward to going to Gagan's after literally every improv show that we do.
The second best part of our show.
That's right.
Sometimes best.
Yes. 10 plus years and counting. And it's just, we're just going to keep on keeping on.
Very cool. And somehow in the midst of putting together this festival and doing lots of performances, you still managed to get to see three movies?
Three movies?
You
can't
don't
believe
sleep,
that?
Or do you have a clone?
A little from column A, a little from column B. No, the reason I was able to do three is because the folks here at the station were kind enough to hook me up with tickets to the special preview screening of Dr. Sleep on Wednesday night at the Bangor Mall Cinemas. Had that not happened, two would have probably been my max because it was such a busy weekend. But I was able to get in there and check that out. So that was really great.
Well, shall we start with that then?
Yeah, let's talk about that because I was a big fan of the book Dr. Sleep, which was I think came out in 2013, if I remember correctly. Mr. King, prolific though he is, isn't necessarily a big fan of. He doesn't do a lot of sequels. Like he's done some series over the, but like direct sequels haven't really been a thing for him. But Dr. Sleep was a sequel to his classic novel, The Shining. That features, that basically falls around a grown-up Dan Torrance dealing with not just the aftermath of what happened to him when he was a kid, but also the cropping up of a new evil that he has to confront. I actually mentioned this to Carrie on my way out the door after the show. The writer director of Dr. Sleep, Mike Flanagan, is maybe the best possible person to put together to work on a movie like this. You might remember he did he directed and did the adaptation of Gerald's Game that aired on Netflix a couple years back, and just has such a wonderful just understanding of sort of both sides of the King ethos, the scary stuff, but also the emotional heart of the thing. And to be able to put those two parts together in a way that fits is really hard. Like, we've seen a lot of people over the years try and be successful in one or the other aspect, but it's rare to get both of them together. And he did it with Gerald's Game. And I got to tell you, he did it with Dr. Sleep too, because this was a great, great movie. We're following around. Danny Torrance is now Dan Torrance, played by Ewan McGregor. He's grown up and is struggling with a lot of the same issues that his dad struggled with, alcoholism and, prone to fits of violence and all this stuff. All the while, he's still, fighting off the leftover demons from what happened when he was a child. And so, you know, he struggles with, you know, he struggles with these issues. And then finally just packs up and is like, just gets on the bus and goes and winds up in a small town, Fraser, New Hampshire, where he wants to start over. And thanks to encountering some kind-hearted folks while there, he's able to do that and start a new life. And, you know, he gets a new job. He joins AA. The Dr. Sleep of the title is sort of the nickname that he gets at the hospice that he works at, because he's able to utilize his shine, his abilities to sort of help these terminally ill people like calmly make their way into the next world. You know, it's the sort of thing that you know, it's not really talked about, but everybody knows it's that sort of deal. Also in this world we have a group of other people of possessed of otherworldly abilities that call themselves the True Knot. They're led by a woman who calls herself Rose the Hat, played by Rebecca Ferguson, who's excellent in this movie. And they basically live by stealing the shine from other people, specifically children. There's a very intense and surprisingly long scene where we sort of bear witness to what happens that I'm not going to go into detail. It's really unsettling. But yeah, that's their deal. They basically crisscross the country in RVs, like in pursuit of sort of the, you know, pursuing these people so they can continue to, you know, sap their powers. Dan, sort of inadvertently becomes sort of psychic pen pals with a young lady who lives in a nearby town, named Abra, who has a very powerful shine. And when the True Knot catches wind of this power, they decide that they want it for themselves. And, Dan Torrance is not going to allow that to happen. And so they sort of try to come together in a way to fight off the True Knot. And that plan, unfortunately, involves young Mr. Torrance having to revisit some of his childhood traumas in ways that he's not necessarily fully equipped for, but he's willing to do whatever it takes to help save this young lady from the fate that he has learned is far worse than death. I'm not going to go anymore because I don't want to spoil anything.
Right.
The really interesting thing about this movie is, and Flanagan's on record saying that this is something that he wanted to do. He wanted to do a faithful adaptation of the book while also remaining in conversation with the movie, with Kubrick's The Shining, which Stephen King is notoriously, you know, he's expressed some misgivings about Kubrick's vision in the past. And, you know, you hear something like that and it's like, well, how the hell is he going to do that? Like, that doesn't even, like, I don't even know how you would begin. And then you sit and watch the movie and it's like, oh, that's how. Like, it's great. Like, he just has this wonderful connection. Like, he finds all these wonderful ways to sort of touch on the sort of the visual iconography that Kubrick introduced into the story while still being very loyal to the narrative that King put forth in the book, and finding ways to sort of tie them together, like both, like, you know, in both a macro and a micro sense. It's really just a remarkable piece of filmmaking. You know, and, you know, he directed, he wrote the adaptation, he edited the movie. Like, I mean, it's just like, it's a full-on Mike Flanagan joint, and he just knocks it out of the park. I mean, he had some help, obviously. Ewan McGregor was a great choice for grown-up Dan Torrance. I wasn't sure about it when I first heard the casting, but I thought he did a phenomenal job. Rebecca Ferguson is such a talented actress. Like, she's so good. And in the wrong hands, that part in particular could have been, like, off-putting in a lot of ways. Like, very flat, very one note. And she just endows it with all this wonderful nuance. And it just really one of the more memorable, like, villains of the sort of the King cinematic universe. Which is saying something, because there have been some really great ones. But yeah, she really kind of captures that essence. And just in terms of the visual styling, the storytelling, like, it's just a phenomenal movie going experience. And it's really funny because it wasn't as it wasn't as successful at the box office this weekend.
Yeah, you know, we were talking about that a little bit earlier off the air as well, and a little bit surprising. There's, you know, a lot of stuff out there, but we wonder too if maybe what's been generally a very positive word of mouth might boost things in the second weekend.
I would think so, because it's you know, the critical response has been very strong. And it's just one of those things where, for whatever reason, people just didn't go. But I mean, I think that's a general sort of thing with regards to the movies, period.
Right.
Especially in this, I think I saw the down like almost 30% from last year in terms of total turnout. So, you know, there are fewer people going, you know, four new releases this week. And, yep. You know, so it's just like, you know, a number of factors sort of combining into this perfect storm that, you know, meant that it only made, you know, $18 million at the box office or whatever. I mean, it's a perfectly acceptable box office take. I think people just thought it was going to be, more. I certainly thought it was going to be more. It certainly deserved to be more, but we'll wait and see. I have a hunch this one's going to have some legs. Like, we'll see how it plays out. But I think, people are going to keep going.
And if, you know, a Rotten Tomatoes audience score on this is any indication, the word of mouth is going to be pretty good. They've got like a 90% audience score, which is very high for.
Yeah. And, you know, and some of my fellow critics were not necessarily as high on the movie as I am, for reasons that. Well, I feel like there's a slight sort of baked in bias against Mr. King's work that I don't necessarily understand or approve of, but there are some folks out there who, like, they're not going to give this movie the chance that it deserves, because his name is on it, and that's there are a lot of nose in the air snobs out there, and. I, on the other hand, am a man of the people.
Well, all right, man of the people. What did you think of The Rock as a Fireman?
Oh, it's not The Rock.
It's not The Rock. It's the other guy.
It's John Cena.
The other Rock, John Cena.
Who they're trying desperately to turn into The Rock.
The other Rock. I should know this because we watch a lot of Nickelodeon in our house, and man, are they pumping the heck out of this movie.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it's and understandably so, because it is very much, this is very squarely in the Nickelodeon demographic.
Yes.
As far as movies go. Yeah, it's called Playing with Fire. It stars John Cena as a smoke jumper, one of those firefighters that parachutes into forest fires to help put them out. He's sort of the chief of this crew, this firefighting crew. You know, he basically winds up with three children, you know, under his watch, through reasons that don't really matter. Like he rescues them from a fire, but like, it doesn't matter how the kids show up. You just know the kids are going to show up and then hijinks are going to ensue, mm-hmm. because that's how these things work. Yeah. His name's Jake Carson. He's the big deal chief at this fire station. Like, he's been raised to do this job. Like, his dad was a smoke jumper, and so he was basically raised at the fire station, and it's all he's wanted to do for his entire life. He's got this crew of of weirdos and misfits. It's a great cast. Like, Keegan-Michael Key is in it, John Leguizamo, Judy Greer is in the movie as well. So he's got his crew. They go to a reported fire at an isolated cabin, where it turns out there are three kids there, a teen, a tween, and a toddler, basically. And they rescue them. And then due to the complexities of the safe haven law, the kids basically have to stay at the fire station. There are some holes in terms of the plot that don't necessarily get addressed, but that's fine. So it's basically three kids in a fire station with zero impulse control and no desire to pay the least bit of attention to any sort of authority figure. And so, basically the stuff that you would expect to happen happens. Like, you know, they get into the hoses and the assorted other things, all while Jake, John Cena, is also trying to figure out how to properly apply for the soon-to-be-open commander position that is about to be vacated by... I don't remember his name, but it's played by Dennis Haysbert. So he has to figure out, he's like, you know, what that job would mean to him. All the while, these kids are running wild. But he's also starting to learn how to feel just a little bit more rich.
Sure, of course he is.
You know, and so those emotional barriers are breaking down. And Jake Carson needs to find out a little bit more about Jake Carson.
Oh, I bet those kids will help him do it.
They are snarky and sarcastic in all the ways that kids in these movies are snarky and sarcastic. And there's an ongoing bit where the littlest one has basically turned Jake's vicious dog into the dog's name was like Bruiser or something, and she just calls the dog Princess Sparkle Pony, and that apparently turns the dog.
That's enough.
Yep. And then there's a big tall dude with a beard who's called Axe, because he carries an axe all the time. Doesn't talk, but he does tea parties and the thing, and they all love My Little Pony, and it's a whole thing. Look, you might guess from the way I talked about this movie that it doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
It doesn't have to, though.
No, that's not what it's about. I actually have a sort of affection for John Cena as a performer.
Well, that's why I mentioned The Rock. I'm confusing them because, much like The Rock, he's got a likable on-screen persona. You can't take your eyes off the guy.
Yeah, no, he's very charming. He's got a genuine sense of humor, and he's unafraid to look foolish. And that's half the battle with movies like this. Like, he's just like there's. You know, you would think that like these guys build their personas, the pro wrestling personas, on ego and stuff like that. But he really does have a tendency to give egoless performance in that, like, he doesn't. There's nothing forced about what he does. Like, he's, as long as he stays in his lane. You don't want him to get, you don't want Shakespeare out of John Cena. Like, that's not what you're looking for. But he's. You know, he's got decent comic timing. His physical comedy skills are on point. You know, he's obviously, got a great sense of his own physicality from his previous, his previous life. And yeah, he does a fine job of carrying this movie. Is it a good movie? No. It's not a bad movie either. And that's the thing. It's got some pretty funny sort of slapsticky set pieces. The emotional payoff is kind of forced, but that's okay. Like, you're not necessarily looking for a lot of nuance when you go to see a movie like this. The supporting cast is great. Keegan-Michael Key is wonderful. Leguizamo brings it, and the kids in the screening that I saw were delighted.
Oh, of course.
Like, they were having an absolute blast. And, you know, if the adults in the room are going to roll their eyes a couple of times, so what? Like, that's... You know, it's not a big deal. And here's the thing, it's not for you.
Right.
You know, it's for the kids, and the kids are going to have a blast.
All right, let's go to the third one here. If you had said 20 years ago, Woody Harrelson starring as Chester Nimitz, not sure anybody would have bought that, but Woody's added some depth. He really is a talented actor, and man, what a cast put together for Midway.
You know, it's funny because... the Battle of Midway, huge turning point in World War II, one of the most important battles in the history of the United States military, all of this. Obviously it's a perfect sort of target for a cinematic exploration. I think the movie, also called Midway, on which I think this one is partially based, I want to say it was like 1976 or something like that.
Sounds about right. I remember seeing in the theater when it came out.
Yeah. So things have evolved in terms of, the technological capabilities and all that stuff. Although I looked at that old, at that previous movie, also an all-star cast.
Oh, yeah. Like, Mitchum, I think, was in it.
Yeah. Charlton Heston. Yeah. Afonda. I don't remember which one. But, yeah. But yeah, and so to bring that story to the screen, it makes a lot of sense, especially at this time of year, a lot of the memories, a lot of the folks with direct memories of that time are leaving us, mm-hmm. And so to sort of capture that on screen, I think is important. I'm not sure Roland Emmerich was the guy, because his oeuvre is basically explosions, like big CGI explosions and dialogue that doesn't really click. And he's had a great run, he's as good at creating like that sort of big budget explodey popcorn cinema as anybody. I'm just not sure that he was necessarily equipped to bring the nuance to this story that maybe it needed. That's not to say it was bad or that it was a bad experience. It was just a little bigger and broader than I was maybe anticipating. And you mentioned Harrelson as Nimitz, Dennis Quaid as Bull Halsey. And then you've got this wonderful cast, Patrick Wilson as Edward Layton, the gentleman who was basically behind the intelligence that led us to foresee the attack on Midway. And then Ed Skrein and Luke Evans and... got a couple of pop stars in there with Mandy Moore and Nick Jonas. Yeah. who's actually quite good, if a little over the top. And it's basically, it follows the story from the pre-war years when Wilson was, when Layton was the, you know, assistant, the junior attaché with in Tokyo, talking with his, sort of opposite number about the potential of the two sides winding up at war. And then we follow some of these pilots on the aircraft carriers in the lead up to and immediate aftermath of Pearl Harbor. And then we sort of watch as we build towards this climactic battle of Midway. I wanted to love this movie because I love a good war movie. I didn't quite get there. And there are a number of reasons for that. One of the big issues I had, and I think a lot of people are going to have, is it's got a gigantic cast, and it's a bunch of dudes, bunch of white dudes wearing the exact same uniform, and so it's easy to lose track of who is who, especially among the sort of the second and third tier characters. Like, you sort of lose track of who's who, and there's just so many different stories that are being told that it's tough to keep track of. There's just not room enough for all of it. Like you mentioned Harrelson as Nimitz, he's only in like five scenes. Same with Quaid. Really Skrein and to a lesser extent Evans are kind of the centerpiece of it. They're both pilots, and so we get a lot of aerial stuff, a lot of sea battles and those sorts of things. And those scenes are really intense. Maybe a little CGI heavy for my tastes, but really like intense and well executed. And you really get swept up into the sort of intensity of the moment. And one of the things that Emmerich has always done well is to sort of he has that knack of sort of dropping you into those sorts of really huge sort of situations and really capturing what it's like to sort of be in the middle of that. And so that part of it's really great. It's when we sort of venture a little farther afield from the battlefield that things kind of struggle a little bit. There are a couple of bits that feel kind of extraneous. Like there's this whole sequence that takes place in like an officer's club in Hawaii that like, it's just, I mean, I understand why it's there, but it doesn't need to be, that sort of thing. And of course I say that. And then there's another extraneous bit that I absolutely loved and was thrilled, because John Ford is a character in this movie. Cause he was apparently at, Midway, at one of the islands, the Marshall Islands, maybe.
Okay.
We're at Midway, actually filming stuff for one of his movies.
Yep.
when one of the attacks came. And so they have like John Ford as a character, and I'm just like, and I liked that because it gave a nice sort of tie to the sorts of movies that Emmerich's clearly trying to emulate here. Those sort of war epics that guys like John Ford would make, back in the 50s and 60s, like those sorts of films. And look, It's not a history lesson that you're getting with Midway, but it's really wonderful to see a story like that receiving this kind of treatment, just because While it's not necessarily the word perfect history of that moment in time, you know what? If that's what someone knows, at least they know.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
at least that's information being passed along. And so, 65% accuracy, I'll take it.
Sure.
A lot of stuff blows up. And let me tell you, some of those action sequences, they're big, they're loud, and they're a lot of fun to watch.
There you go. Alan Adams breaking down three for us this week on Pass the Popcorn. Thank you, Al.
My pleasure.